Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobody's been looking perfect in the world financial panic of 2008. Markets careening all over. Europe's big banks in trouble. Iceland broke. But the shot heard around the world that started the whole thing came out of Wall Street. And it's the American model of what-me-worry capitalism that's taking the heat, a lot of the blame. This crisis was born in America, says the French president, and the world is nodding yes. This hour, On Point, global financial crisis and where the U.S. will be standing when the dust has settled. A special welcome to our day to our newest listeners on WYQS 90.5 FM in Mars Hill, North Carolina, and WCQS HD2 in Asheville, North Carolina. We look forward to hearing from you. Joining me first today from London for an update on the global crisis and the global rescue effort is Daniel Hertzberg, Deputy Managing Editor at The Wall Street Journal and editor of the journal's European and Asian editions. Daniel, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Big meetings all over this weekend. How would you characterize the effort that has come out of this effort to coordinate a global response?
Well, I think it's the most unified effort they've had, and we're really beginning to see the pattern of the rescue that a lot of different countries have agreed on.
And the pattern is a lot of intervention for banks. Is it a homogeneous kind of response, or is each country going to have its own way?
Well, each country, to some extent, has to have its own way, because in Europe, there's no one institution that can do all this. But what we're seeing is, and in many ways, it's copying or based on what they've done in the UK, which is to attack several problems all at the same time. One is the fact that the banks do not have enough capital. A lot of banks do not have enough capital. That's their cushion that they use to take losses on. Mm-hmm. And what's happened, and the U.S. has just done this now too, is the governments have said, we will give you capital. We will buy in, whether it's buying stock or preferred stock. We will buy in and put money into you that you can use as capital. But they're also doing things. Banks are not lending to each other, and banks are built on borrowed money. If they can't borrow, they're out of business. And actually, some of them have gone out of business and had to be taken over. And what the governments are also doing now is, in one way or another, guaranteeing their lending, guaranteeing debt that they issue in order to borrow money. In some cases, borrow from each other.
Daniel, you're watching this from London, and a lot of the model here came out of the UK and UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown. What about the US role in this whole global response? Do you see Washington as leading, following, one of the pack? How does it look?
Well, I don't think they're leading in the sense that they've come around. We had the big Paulson plan and the $760 billion, which is certainly a very big number, that was passed, which was basically to buy the bad assets, toxic assets from the banks. But I think what they realized in the UK and the US has now accepted too is this idea that you've really got to attack these other problems, and particularly the need for capital.
Here's President Bush this morning announcing a plan to buy $250 billion in leading American banks. He said the drastic steps here are not intended to take over the free market, but to preserve it.
This weekend I met with finance ministers from the G7 and the G20, organizations representing some of the world's largest and fastest growing economies. We agreed on a coordinated plan for action to provide new liquidity, strengthen financial institutions, protect our citizen savings, and ensure fairness and integrity in the markets.
President Bush today, Daniel Hertzberg with The Wall Street Journal joins us from London. Daniel, we've heard a lot of criticism of the American role in this meltdown from Europeans in particular, though not only from Europe. We had the German finance minister saying, you know, probably the U.S. will lose its status, quoting him here, as the superpower of the global financial system. French President Sarkozy, very tough on the U.S., saying, you know, this laissez-faire era is over. The German chancellor, Angela Merkel, saying that these new measures are laying the first cornerstone for a new economic structure. Is this an American-style structure or something new?
Well, it's something in between. There's no question that the crisis began in the U.S. with the subprime lending problems. And there was a lot of schadenfreude in Europe, people saying, look at that cowboy Anglo-Saxon, capitalism. But as, especially in the last week or so, as this, the problems have spread more and more to European banks involving problems that don't have to do with the subprime, I think that's disappearing. I think there's a recognition that this is a universal problem. Is there going to be a change? Absolutely. There's going to be more regulation. There's no question about that.
And does it seem to portend the end of an era of a certain style of capitalism where the tune is called on Wall Street?
Well, you've got to be careful about using the word capitalism. We're not talking about the steel industry. We're not talking about the auto industry. Mm-hmm. We're talking about financial markets. And there is no question there that there was, you know, a lack of regulation. Clearly, regulators and the people who ran many of these institutions did not understand the risks that were going on. And that's why this crisis developed.
Do you get the feeling that when the G7, the G20, whoever you want to talk about, looks for the way forward now, they're looking, they will look less to Washington? Does it mean that voices elsewhere are just going to be more prominent, more louder in determining, to the extent there's a global economy, the direction in which it moves, Daniel?
Well, I think the answer is yes, but. And the but is the U.S. is still a huge part of the global economy, and that's not going to end. The U.S. markets are crucial, and in fact, if there's one thing this crisis emphasized, it's how global the markets are and how a problem, subprime loans, which most people had never heard of, could spread not just in the U.S., but all around the world very, very quickly.
Daniel Hertzberg, Pulitzer Prize-winning Deputy Managing Editor at The Wall Street Journal, joining us from London. Thanks very much for being with us, Daniel.
Thank you.
I want to turn now to Eswar Prasad. He joins us from Washington. He's a professor of trade policy at Cornell University, a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Eswar Prasad, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's good to be on your show.
It's great to have you. So we're looking out here on a kind of a new world out of the rubble of everything that's fallen in the last few weeks. Markets feeling in a bounce-back mood early in this week around the world. But clearly, things have changed and are changing here. How do you see the United States emerging on the other side of this crisis? How do you think its standing, its sway will look compared to what they were going into the panic of 08?
First of all, Tom, it's a great relief that today we're talking about the dust settling rather than the sky falling, which was a bigger concern
yes,
as of last week.
We hope.
So at least the tenor of the debate has changed. The perception of the U.S. as being the intellectual driver of free market capitalism around the world is certainly going to take a beating. But the interesting thing, Tom, is that although the U.S. approach to that model may have been discredited, I think many countries around the world, in fact, see it as inevitable that they're, in fact, going to continue moving towards a more market-oriented system. But one has to be a little careful in thinking about the U.S. model, because the U.S. has, of course, been preaching a very laissez-faire of free market capitalism, not just in the industrial sector, but also in the financial system. And it turns out that, in fact, what the U.S. was practicing was rather different. On the one hand, you did have a certain amount of implicit government intervention. For instance, Fannie and Freddie clearly had the government standing behind them, and the market saw this. On the other hand, you had this very Wild West sort of capitalism where financial markets were entirely unregulated. So the world now sees this very clearly, that what the U.S. was saying in terms of letting markets take over and arguing that there would be self-correcting mechanisms in the market is clearly going to be overthrown. But on the other hand, it's very clear to countries around the world, especially the large emerging market economies and relatively closed ones like China and India too, that the way forward is to have stronger financial systems. And they need the stronger financial systems just so they can continue having strong growth rates so that the savings that their consumers and households do is going to be effectively channeled into domestic investment. And more important, given that we are seeing that these problems do have a global dimension, these countries recognize that they need to fortify their financial systems. And fortification does not necessarily mean shutting them off to the rest of the world. I think they see the process of opening themselves up as inevitable. It's going to go on whether the policymakers like it or not. But they're going to do it in their own way, and they're no longer going to listen to the U.S. tell them how to do it and how soon to do it. So that is going to be a very fundamental shift in terms of the power structure when it comes to discussions of international financial policies.
But does that then mean a real turn in what we understand as, you know, global capitalism, globalization, if the U.S. isn't the last word anymore, or the first for that matter, if it's not the kind of arbiter of what free market capitalism is, and maybe China, India, others have more to say about it, does that mean a different system, a different economic environment globally or not?
Many countries like China and India, especially those countries, but other emerging markets as well, have been approaching it in their own way. And the U.S., of course, has been hectoring them to do it in the U.S. way. That will be much harder to sustain. I think countries will go off on their own path. But the fact that you do have these countries opening up more to international capital flows because they see certain benefits from that, the fact that they are developing their financial systems because they see very broad benefits from that, that is going to continue. But they're definitely going to approach it much more cautiously. Let me give you a very specific example about how things have changed. On this side, we have Paulson and Bernanke effectively taking over parts of the financial system, banning short selling and taking what seemed like fairly drastic steps, especially in the context of American financial capitalism. At the same time, in China, in the midst of these crises, you have statements coming out that they need a stronger financial market. So in fact, there is a recognition there that the U.S. crisis doesn't mean they stop progress, but they channel progress in a different way.
Ishwar Prasad, please stand by. We'll come back and be joined by Frederick Mishkin in just a moment. We're looking at the U.S. in the global economy now. This is On Point. Joined right now as well from New York by Frederick Mishkin. Until August, he was a member, a governor, of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. He's professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Business, an expert in economic crashes. Frederick Mishkin, thanks very much for being with us.
It's good to be here.
We're trying to just get a sense of where the United States stands or is likely to stand as we work through this crisis and hopefully get to the other side. We've seen very tough words out of Europe from allies and from those kind of in the middle, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev saying, you know, this is all about this fall, this crash is about U.S. egoism. He said the times when one economy and one country dominated are gone for good. We may have friends who are better than the Russian president. But how do you see what's happening to U.S. standing and influence with all this, Professor Mishkin?
Well, the two things I'd like to emphasize. First of all, although that the epicenter was the United States, there were a lot of willing partners in this throughout the world. European banks were as actively involved in all of the subprime purchase of subprime mortgage securities, just to the same extent that the American banks were. So it's a worldwide problem. The second issue is that the basic model of global capitalism, it's down, but it's far from out. In fact, it's the only way forward for poorer countries. This is exactly the point that the Professor Prasad made, which is that if they're going to get rich, and this is a point that I very strongly emphasized on my book on globalization that was published about 2 years ago.
This is the next great globalization, yes.
Yes, that in fact, if they're going to get rich, they have to enter the global capital markets, but they do have to do it their own way. Indeed, one size does not fit all. Financial development shows that, that there's not just one model of doing it, but the basic principle that you let markets work, but on the other hand, have good institutional frameworks to regulate them properly is absolutely critical.
But what about the price to the United States if its reputation has been damaged in this crisis, if people are not taking advice from the U.S. quite so readily, not investing in the U.S. quite so readily? What does that cost the United States, Frederick Mishkin?
Well, I think there is a cost, I think, certainly temporarily in terms of soft power. This is issued not just in terms of our leadership in terms of economics, but also in terms of financial, in terms of foreign policy as well. But I think we need to take a longer-term perspective. Remember that the Great Depression was also a period where there was a view that the United States was going to be less important and that capitalism was not the way of the future. And then look what happened afterwards. And in fact, the U.S. and the kind of capitalism that was developed in the U.S. really became the wave of the future. So I think there's a temporary problem here. It is going to have a lot of criticism of the U.S. It means soft power has been weakened. But I think in the long run, the basic model that the U.S. has, which is capitalism but not laissez-faire, good regulation is a key part of the success of the United States. And sometimes we've had cases of too much deregulation swings back to re-regulation. If the re-regulation is done right, then indeed the U.S. Model is going to be the dominant one.
Eshwar Prasad, how about the historical comparison? Coming out of the Great Depression, of course, the world plunged into World War II. And on the other side of that, the United States was the great superpower. Do you see a path, something like that, ahead here? Or are we in a fundamentally different era with new economies, China, India, and globalization, beneath us as never before? How about the historical analogy?
The world economic order is definitely changing, Tom, and I think that process is going to perhaps be pushed forward a little faster after this episode. But let's take a step back, as mm-hmm. Professor Mishkin pointed out, and think about the broader picture, and let's think about some facts regarding the U.S. The U.S. is running a current account deficit of nearly $800 billion. That's the amount of money it needs from the rest of the world to
every
finance
year.
Its consumption every year. Mm-hmm. The budget deficit is about 3% of GDP, and it's likely to rise. The amount of public debt is 70% of GDP, which is very large even by developing country standards. If this sort of financial turmoil hit any other country, that country would have a collapsing currency and would be in very deep trouble internationally. And yet, if you think about the flight to quality around the world right now, where is that quality? It's still in the U.S. The U.S. still has the deepest, most liquid bond markets. And when people talk about a flight to quality, they fly to U.S. government bonds. It is a remarkable fact that despite what is happening in the U.S., the U.S. is still seen as the beacon of safety in the middle of what is going on. So I think we have to recognize that this doesn't mean that the U.S. financial system is necessarily the best or the strongest. Clearly, recent events have proved not to be so. But other countries still haven't quite caught up. Their financial markets are still developing. And as Professor Mishkin has emphasized in his book, and I think this is a very important point, opening up to international capital flows and so on is a way that many of these countries have been able to develop their own financial systems. And I think that process will continue. Of course, China and India and the other emerging market economies are going to become much more important. So there is going to be a bit of a rebalancing. But it's not like that has happened yet or is going to happen imminently. What is definitely going to happen is that the role of the U.S. in this intellectual debate is going to shift. But the center of power is gradually going to shift, but we are far from having the U.S. Removed as the center of economic power in the world. It's still the largest and most dominant economy.
As many questions as answers, a lot of them from our listeners. Let's go to one right here. Ed, truck driver on I-35 in Missouri. Ed, you're on the air, my friend.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Oh, I just wondering if we go ahead with all this bailout and everything, and they don't stop their spending, or all the governments, or mainly ours, isn't that going to spiral us right back to the starting point again?
The debt that we take on to actually carry out the bailout. Let us pick it up, Ed, and thanks for your call. Frederick Mishkin, how about it? The borrowing that we're doing for the bailout, we hear, is more borrowing from around the world, from abroad. Take us back to we came out of the Great Depression and did just fine, thank you. Take us to that analogy. Ed wants to know about the borrowing we're doing now. Eshwar Prasad points out that we have debts now, a kind of a back-on-our-heels posture that we didn't have during the 1930s. How do you see it?
Well, instead of going back to the 1930s, I think there's a closer historical event that was very, very instructive, which is the savings and loan bailout, which occurred in the late 1980s.
Okay.
And I think it has a tremendous number of lessons for today. The first point is, and actually here's the only case where I slightly disagree with Professor Prasad, mm-hmm. which is the amount of U.S. government debt, the net government debt is actually not that high. It's more in the neighborhood of around 35%. And the key
35%
issue, of GDP.
35%
of GDP.
Okay.
So it's not
that
not 70.
Big to me. Okay.
It's big, but actually historically not very not all that high.
Okay.
And a key point here is first that the bailout, even if it's very large, is not going to amount to more than several percentage points of GDP. It's a one-shot affair. If you want to get scared about our fiscal situation, think about Medicare. That's really scary.
Okay.
The second point is that if you look at what happened in terms of the bailout in the late 1980s, the scale of that bailout is probably on a similar order. It was in dollars in that time was around $150 billion, which is multiplied by a substantial amount because the price level has risen. And in fact, that did not lead to a huge long-run problem in terms of the amount of government debt. And the second issue is that if it's done right, that you can actually put in place regulation which makes the system work better. So sometimes it doesn't happen, but in that case, the bailout was done first in 1989 with a provision that there had to be new regulations put into place and a Treasury had to come up with a plan. That led to legislation in 1991, which was very important because it actually created a much sounder and safer banking system. In fact, if that legislation hadn't been passed and this crisis had occurred, which started mostly outside the banking system, then we'd be in super deep trouble. We're in a bad enough trouble as it is, but it would have been much worse. So I think the answer here is if, in fact, we re-regulate and we do it properly, we'll have a stronger system because we'll have learned some lessons. But then again, you have to depend on the politicians, and you never know what's going to happen in that case.
Ishwar Prasad, how about it? Never mind the Great Depression for a moment. Just look back to the 80s. We took the SNL bailout in stride and had the 90s boom. Do you see that as a possible path in sitting in front of the United States right now coming out of this crisis?
I think the savings and loan debacle, the Japanese lost decade recently, plus the Great Depression and so on, have a set of very important common lessons, some of which Professor Mishkin has already alluded to. And what encourages me in this instance is that the authorities have moved very forcefully. These are large, dramatic steps they have taken, and there are questions about how best one would use the sort of arsenal that they have behind them right now. But the fact that they have recognized the seriousness of the problem and taken really forceful steps early, I think, is a very encouraging aspect of how it's been handled. But there is a risk that the way it's handled might create problems for the future because, after all, the U.S. government is getting rather deeply involved in running the financial system. So they will have to figure out how to extricate themselves from that because I don't think it's in anybody's interest that the government remain deeply involved in the financial system. But at this stage, I think it's a very good idea not to leave any arrows in the quiver, just to throw whatever can be marshaled against the problem. And then once the dust has settled, as you put it, then to deal with these longer term issues, having better regulation, getting the government out of the financial system and so forth. And there'll be time for that.
Frederick Mishkin, I still want to come back to this Great Depression analogy that you raised, because the Depression's been very much in the headlines and on people's minds lately. The U.S. came out of that like ultimately, it took a long time, but came out like gangbusters ultimately, but did that as the kind of industrial leader of the world when the rest of the world was very widely in rubble after World War II. Do we still have that capacity? We have the sense, even looking back on the 90s now, that came after the SNL crisis, that it was a kind of a bubble boom. And the boom of this decade or the growth of this decade also bubble built. We see, you know, GM plants being closed and all kinds of trouble for American manufacturing now. Do you see the fundamentals there? Fundamentals, not for a bubble, not for another bubble, but for, you know, real economic strength in this country coming out of this crisis. And where would you see that strength grounded?
Well, I actually think that there is a positive, which is that productivity growth has accelerated in the late 1990s. And even in the current crisis, productivity growth has also been very high. So our current problems are indeed very serious. But from a longer-term perspective, that being able to put capital use in efficient ways and get new innovation, and we are a very, very innovative economy, that really is what is absolutely most critical.
So innovate, but on the base of what industry?
Well, we have tremendous number of industries. Many of them are brand new. When you think about many of the products that we use today, They're very, very different. The kind of services, for example, think about the way we use the internet. I couldn't live without it. My view is if my phone goes dead, I don't care. But boy, if my computer goes dead, then it's a nightmare for me. What a different world that is from what it was like so many years ago. I started using punch cards using computers. Mm. That's the bad old days. Think about where we are now.
Yeah, we're looking for that firm footing in the midst of crisis. Let's get a call from Acton, Massachusetts. And Mark. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see, Mark?
Good. Well, you know, the United States has been a leader in the world financial system, partly because of the strength of our economy, but also because of our regulatory system, which for decades after the Depression emphasized capital formation. Mm-hmm. The last 20 years, we've gotten more into derivatives, which are really a form of legalized gambling and don't directly help with capital formation. And you may remember Warren Buffett famously called them economic weapons of mass destruction.
Yep.
The good news going forward is that we know, we have good clues as to what caused this particular crash, and it was Phil Gramm in the Senate with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act.
Mm-hmm.
And what that did essentially was open up a $62 trillion segment of the worldwide market for derivatives and put it beyond regulatory reach. So the immediate problem is to restore liquidity, and I'm glad to see that the Europeans have taken the lead and we appear to be ready to follow.
Right.
To get us past the liquidity crisis. But once we're past this, we have to learn the lesson that I thought we had learned in the 30s, which is that the whole purpose of the regulatory system is to encourage capital formation and not to reward gambling. And that's what these derivatives, for the most part, have become.
Mark, let us pick it up exactly there. Frederick, Michigan, this is right on your terrain. You're saying financial systems evolve and they make mistakes as they do. We just had a doozy. What we can learn from this and go forward. But Mark wants to know very specifically on the capital formation versus the casino of derivatives front, how the U.S. may respond. Can that put us back in good standing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm much more positive about derivatives than our caller is.
Why?
But I'll explain why. Mm-hmm. That financial innovation, this actually process of financial development, is one that's been going on for hundreds of years. And that where the caller is absolutely right is that when you first get an innovation, you may not get it right, and in fact, you may not have the proper regulation. And that requires changes. But actually what we see is a lot of these financial innovations, which are first are people saying they're just gambling, they actually help us allocate capital. And the key to a successful economy, is that you actually allocate capital to people with productive investment opportunities. And financial development and financial innovation has served us very, very well over time. However, when you get it wrong, you have to modify it. So, for example, there are many elements of the derivatives markets, in particular credit derivatives, that are going to be relooked at. And for example, the use of exchanges is going to be something that's going to be a very important issue going forward instead of the way that they've been done in the past. That the quality of information that the markets have and that individuals have has to be much clearer. So there is a lot to be done here.
But if that's so obvious, why not before all these trillions were lost? I can imagine people listening with some skepticism. You were in the Fed while this bubble grew. Maybe you drank the Kool-Aid.
Right, but here is the issue. When you look at history of financial development, the answer is when you try something new, you may think you're going to get it completely right, and boy, you don't.
So very expensive lesson. People's retirement savings gone.
Absolutely, but let me give you an example here, which is part of our problem right now is that the securitization model is broken and has to be fixed. So what the idea here was, gee, it's great. We can originate mortgages, have somebody separate do that, and then people start to package it, and there are many people down the line. The problem was the people originating and packaging didn't care whether it got paid back, whether the mortgage got paid back, and whether the ultimate holder of the security actually got paid back. Mm. That model clearly needs to be fixed. On the other hand, that kind of innovation can be very beneficial in the long run. We've seen it happen over and over again over the last couple of hundred years. We don't want to stop the innovation. We just want to get it right.
Frederick Michigan, please stand by. And Eshwar Prasad, we're talking about economic crisis, the global economy, and where the U.S. will stand when the dust settles. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about economic crisis, the global economy, and where the U.S. will stand when the dust settles. We've been joined by Frederick Mishkin. Until August, he was a member, governor of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. He's now professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Business, author of The Next Great Globalization. And we're joined from Washington by Eshwar Prasad, professor of trade policy at Cornell University. Speaking on French television yesterday, French President Nicolas Sarkozy said his country's taking rapid action. Things can't go back. Those responsible must be held accountable. Here's a translation from CNN.
Pour rétablir la confiance rapidement.
We must quickly restore confidence, and I tell you that it is a commitment. Once trust and confidence have been restored, France will not let this go. Those who have been responsible will be sanctioned.
France will not let this go, says Sarkozy. Last week, in an interview with Sky News, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown saying that what happens in America can no longer be allowed to infect Britain. Let's listen.
I've been talking to President Bush. I've been talking to the European leaders. We'll have a world leaders meeting very soon, I think. We're going to have to get agreement on basic principles that underline a banking system. So what happens in America can no longer infect, because something has gone wrong there, what's happening in Britain.
Eshwar Prasad, how do you interpret that? What can that mean? We talk about globalization, about the world being inextricably entwined economically, and then here's the British Prime Minister, and they've taken the lead in this global reaction response here, saying we have to change things, fix things, so that what happens in America can no longer infect what's happening in Britain. Is that possible? What would that mean?
At one level, it's going to be very difficult for any economy to shut itself off from the global financial system. But the nature of engagement with the financial systems is going to change, Tom. But let me tell you an interesting parable about how things are being handled in the U.S. and how other countries see it. Mm. In the U.S., we recently had this ban on short selling, given that short selling was viewed by some as being an important contributor to declines in stock prices and so on. The new Indian securities market regulator, the chairman of that regulator, was asked whether he was going to stop short selling in India. And his response was, no, we will not do that, because that is not the problem and that is not the solution. There is a recognition in many of these other countries, including the less developed ones, that there are many benefits to financial innovation if there is proper regulation. Many countries are moving towards more flexible exchange rates, China, India, and so on. And there is a need for households, for corporates to be able to hedge exchange rate risk. So although we talk about derivatives as being somehow evil, there are many benefits that you can actually get from derivatives in terms of hedging foreign currency risk and other types of risks, which is exactly the point that Professor Mishkin made. But what this crisis has taught us is that the laissez-faire sort of capitalism with minimal regulation is not going to work. And it's definitely going to affect how much countries, or how quickly countries move forward allowing financial innovations if they feel they don't have the regulatory capacity to keep up with that. But I think the progress is going to be very difficult to stop, because there are still lots of benefits. And we have seen that if the regulation isn't in place, you can have a spectacular flame out like we've had in the U.S. But I think most countries around the world are recognizing, again, that there are benefits to be had, and that those benefits can come if financial development is taken one step at a time with countries' own circumstances in mind.
But let me ask you, if the United States has been kind of the big cheerleader, the avatar of this minimal regulation for a long time now, now we're moving into a new era where more regulation is going to be required, designed, implemented. Will the United States be the leader in that somehow, given that, you know, all of our major push has been in the other direction for a couple of decades? Or does somebody else take the reins, or are we just, you know, one voice at the table? What do you see, Professor Prasad?
It's going to become a much more dispersed model. There was the attempt by the U.S. to impose its approach to financial markets on the rest of the world, and some countries accepted that, many of the Western industrial countries in particular, largely bought into the model. And as Professor Mishkin said, the blame for the recent financial crisis doesn't just stop in the U.S. There were other countries that essentially had similar sorts of financial markets, perhaps just following the U.S. lead. But it's not clear that around the world this is the model being followed. There are many other countries that are approaching financial development much more cautiously. But in those economies, there is still the recognition that finance is important, but it's important for another reason as well, not just in terms of capital formation, but also in terms of bringing more of the population into the financial net. many people in China and India simply don't have access to a banking system for saving money or for borrowing money. So it's not just a matter of financial innovation, but much broader financial development. And that is one thing I think that has become accepted around the world, that you need a much broader and deeper financial market. But how much financial innovation you need in terms of new instruments, that is the part of the debate where I think the U.S. is definitely going to lose its leadership.
Let's take a call from Aiken, South Carolina. Tom, you're on the air.
My question is why all the commentators kept touring around the political question that was presented by Ronald Reagan. He says, I'm going to get government out of your way and allow the markets to work. That kind of stupidity is the basis of what's going on today. Getting government out of the way. They had the regulation, but yet they're going to get the government out of it.
Tom, let us pick it up. Frederick, Michigan, that's been a kind of byword for a long time. Government's not the answer. Government's the problem. Now you and others are talking about a return to regulation, a revival of a more regulated era. Does this country have the political will to do that? Do the people who sort of pull the levers of power believe in that? Is it going to happen? Will we lead in that?
Well, I think that the caller is exactly right, that when you talk about markets working, that in fact markets only work well when the institutional framework around them means that people trying to make money actually does good rather than bad. And in the era of deregulation that occurred in terms of banks in the early 1980s actually led to some very bad outcomes and a huge bailout of many banks and also many savings and loans.
Yep.
And as a result, there was re-regulation, which basically allowed the banks to work in a better way. And so
well, the SNL, but not the overall system here.
No.
We've just gone through a hellacious,
No, but I disagree here in that the problems that the re-regulation was meant to deal with in the early 1990s actually did help a lot. The difficulty is we had a whole new set of problems and new innovations that just people just didn't get it right. Oops, a disaster occurs. So I think the issue here is, are we going to learn the right lessons from this episode? Something that Professor Prasad said that I think is extremely important is that the difference between what happened in places like in the Great Depression in the U.S. and in Japan in the 1990s is that we've had very quick action to actually get the system working again. But now we have to ask, how do we make sure this does not happen again? And that process does require the politicians to do it right. I don't know. There's always an issue about where they're going to be. But we have seen cases, particularly in the 1991 fiduciary legislation, which really made banking more sound so that when the shadow banking system blew up, which is really the ultimate cause of this problem, it didn't start with the banks per se. It started with the securitization model that blew up and then made the banks blow up. So in this context, let's hope that the politicians do this right, that they don't kill off innovation, that can help actually people get access to credit that didn't get credit before, but actually then make sure that the kind of excesses that we've seen recently don't happen again.
Let's get a call from Melissa in Franklin, Massachusetts. Melissa, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, thank you. I'd like to just point out that from a middle American's point of view, someone who tried to have their own business and do what was needed to get their stock and the equipment they needed and so on,
mm-hmm.
that a big sort of problem is the obsession and the focus on credit and credit cards and how that has become the nature of doing business in America and living daily life, and no one wants to admit that. There are companies like Chase and Citibank and Bank of America that have just run amok and literally taken over the country to the point where if you walk into an ordinary store like the Gap or Walmart or half of these stores, they make you sound like a complete moron if you don't want one of their credit cards. Even in this economy, even with everything we're reading, you can't walk in a store without someone telling you why you ought to open their card and charge everything, why you ought to take a home equity line and pay your bills with that.
Melissa, let us pick it up. Ishwar Prasad, what about it? You say we need to spread credit in a lot of the developing world, but in the U.S., here's Melissa's view. There's been too much dependence on credit and a lot of skeptical onlookers abroad saying, what are you doing, United States, living that deeply in debt?
The key lesson that is coming out of this crisis, which I think relates to this caller's point as well as the previous caller's point, really has to do with what role the government is going to have in the financial markets. And here again, there is a commonality of views emerging around the world, although to different degrees. One is that the government is crucial. But the government is crucial in a very specific way in terms of setting the rules of the game and enforcing the rules of the game, neither of which happened very well in the U.S. In recent times, and I think we are dealing with the consequences of that. But on the other hand, the risk is that the government gets directly involved in the financial system, and that's not a good thing either. And there is a concern that what has happened recently might reinvigorate that particular push towards the government becoming directly involved. And I don't think either of those, I don't think having the government directly involved is a good thing. But what we are learning clearly is that markets are not self-correcting. In other words, if you create a system where a lot of credit can be given to people and people willingly take the credit, I mean, nobody is forcing people to take the credit, but we did have a lack of regulation, which meant that the way this credit was dispersed may not have been efficient or ultimately may have led to this disaster. So having the government set clear rules and enforce them, I think is going to be a critical part of having a financial system that works well without creating these massive risks.
Let's get a call from Charlotte in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Charlotte, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey. My question is, where is all this money coming from? Are countries going to lend this money, or are we going to print it? And if we're going to print it, isn't this highly inflationary? I heard Jim Rogers, the investor, saying that it's going to be an inflationary holocaust. Pura Saxena mentioning inflation again this morning. Where's money coming from?
Good questions, Charlotte. Frederick Mishkin on the bailout. Where does that money come from? Does it just get shoveled from Beijing straight into our coffers and then out to the world? And what about the potential inflationary risk here?
So the way that where the money is going to come from is that the government's going to issue debt. In fact, right now, people are very happy to buy Treasury securities, so it's not going to be a problem for the government to sell this debt. The idea that this is going to be hugely inflationary, I think, is just pure unadulterated nonsense.
Why?
And the reason is that this is a situation where the shock that we've had currently is, in fact, a deflationary shock. It's very contractionary. We're very likely to see sharp falls in inflation. The way that you get inflation is when monetary policy turns on the spigots. There is no way that this Federal Reserve is going to do that. The fact that there's a bailout and a lot of debt issued, that is a problem because it means future taxpayers are going to have to pay for it. But it does not have any inflationary consequences unless the central bank decides that they just want to goose up the economy and cause a lot of inflation. And that is not a characteristic of the way the Federal Reserve has operated for the last 20 years.
Ishwar Prasad, do you agree that we're not facing an inflationary risk with this bailout spending? And what about who's paying for it? Frederick Mishkin points out right now people are snapping up that debt. But is the world going to continue to float the U.S. boat on debt after what we've just been through indefinitely?
Right now, the rest of the world seems very happy to buy this debt, Tom. As Professor Mishkin pointed out, it is still the safe haven in these turbulent times, U.S. government securities, that is. And ultimately, the U.S. taxpayer is going to pay for this. But the focus in the short run really should be on just getting us out of this very deep hole that we may be falling into. Once we get out of the hole, there are things can be done. And again, depending on how we get out of the hole, as Professor Mishkin pointed out, it's not obvious that the cost of the $700 billion bailout or whatever the amount turns out to be is going to fall directly on the taxpayer, because if the system starts working again, the government may recoup much of its investment in this. So right now, I think inflation is not the concern. There is an issue that if the dust does settle, where this money is eventually going to be coming from if the government doesn't recoup all of its investments. And one possibility then, of course, is that the government turns on the printing presses, and there is a concern that people in the market might think that the government is going to turn on the printing presses. But the Federal Reserve system in the U.S. does have enough credibility that very few people are going to believe that it's going to turn on the presses. And if they did think that, it would be very unlikely that they would be snapping up these U.S. treasuries at such low interest rates. So it's a potential concern. But given the other big concerns we have right now, I don't think the focus on inflation is relevant at all at the moment.
Frederick Mishkin, then we've just got a minute and a half left here. Let's get specific on re-regulation. If we're headed into some, where do you think it ought to come first? Where specifically ought it come first to comfort the rest of the world that the U.S. is going to, you know, mind the store here?
Well, one issue that's going to be very important is that particularly with some of the guarantees that are being put, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere, in terms of interbank lending, it's extremely critical that there's appropriate regulation and supervision to make sure that banks don't take on excessive risks because their lending is being guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clearly going to be an issue going forward. And making sure also that if a bank really is not viable, that it shouldn't stay in business just because we're propping it up with a guarantee. So that's going to be very critical going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Also very critical going forward is going to be to ask what kind of information do households and consumers and businesses really need in order to decide that they really can bear the debt. Many households took on debt. They had no idea what they were doing, and they're in big trouble. And it also then led to our economy being in big trouble. So there's going to have to be much more attention to disclosure, much more attention to which products may be too complicated so that, in fact, households and consumers may not be able to figure out what's going on. So we're going to have to think very hard about these issues going forward.
More transparency with the whole world looking in through those windows. I have to say, you're both more optimistic than I had reason to expect. And it's fascinating and comforting. I hope you're right. We'll have to come back at it and see how it's unfolding in another hour. Frederick Mishkin at Columbia University's Graduate School of Business, former governor of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. Thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And Eshwar Prasad, professor of trade policy at Cornell University, joining us today from Washington. Professor Prasad, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank you.